Get your earplugs out. It's about to get loud. This is the Stansberry Radio Black Label Show.
It's time for the Black Label Show, Porter. I'm Aaron Brabham. Of course, I have Porter Stansberry. Porter, we're not doing this with you and I today. We're bringing on a special guest. We're bringing on Dave Colum, a professor, but he's much more than a professor. He was one of our speakers in Dallas. But you've been following his work since how long?
A couple years. Dave Colum is a professor of chemistry. Isn't that right, Dave?
That's right.
Is it organic chemistry?
That's right.
Oh. That's a tough subject for me.
So you teach at Cornell University, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you're probably like one of the weed out professors.
No, actually. No, I've had so many administrative duties. I'm department chair right now, which shows you that you can't find the bottom of the barrel. but I've had so many administrative duties that at best I teach one semester a year because I've got other stuff I got to do. No, I'm not weed out. I spend most of my lectures just cracking jokes, telling stories, and I can get all the information in, but there's no shortage of deviations from the norm.
You're the organic chemistry professor I didn't get at the University
that
of Florida.
Is true.
I got a guy who
that
couldn't speak
true.
English, and I didn't perform very well in that course. But that's not why you're on the Black Label Show. You're on the Black Label Show because you have been writing an annual investment review that is as good or better than anything that I've seen produced by hedge funds or Wall Street banks. And you do it from the perspective of our readers as just a common man who is placing his money, making his bets as he sees the world. But you see the world with a lens that's more clear than most people's, and you have great connections also now on Wall Street. So let's start out with a couple of basics. Is your letter from last year posted anywhere where folks can easily go read it for themselves?
Yeah, I'm told that in a virginal Google account, which means not mine, not yours, not anyone who's been there before, that if you search Dave Goes Rogue, which will link you right to a page in which my group created it, and they've posted all the stuff that I have done, and I've admittedly helped them, that involves non-chemistry stuff. So if you search Dave Goes Rogue,
Dave Goes Rogue on Google search, and you will find Dave Colum's letters.
I'm told it's the top link.
Okay, great.
And there you go.
That's the first part. The second part is I wondered, I did read your letter thoroughly that you wrote at the end of last year, and that's what led to your invitation to speak to our Stansberry Society group in Dallas, where we met for the first time. And your presentation there was excellent as well about the dangers of Roth IRAs. But I wondered, at the end of last year, you were still holding on to your precious metals, and you were still seeing the world darkly, I would say. And has that view changed? And if not, what are the major components of your view today?
That view is not going to change easily because it's a secular view. It's not because the Dow's up at some level, which it is, but it is this sort of inescapable conclusion that I've drawn that we've got either some serious catastrophe in the short term or a very long grinding corrective phase within the United States economy. And so I never trade. I make very few investment decisions each year, and most of it's really just watching and checking my assumptions and stuff. And so last year was a bad year because I had a lot of gold, and the gold market was the most fascinating of all markets, but the price was less than desirable. The change I've made this year, actually, is I'm buying more gold now. I stopped buying around 2004 before, and now I'm back in the market, and I'm buying specifically the physical metal now, not CEF, not equities, which they might pay well, but I'm going straight for the clinky stuff.
Are you looking at like rare coins like St. Gaudens or anything like that, or are you just going more bullion?
No. I pay just a few percent over spot. I have a deal with a local coin broker, and I go down there and I pay cash and and he gives me the coins. And it's a kind of a way of averaging into the market because the coins sort of dribble in. I've been in a meeting all week, and I missed a call from the guy, and I'm sure he's going to tell me he had some ounces. And I just do that. And over the last probably 12 years, I've been doing that. I have a bit of a standing offer. Sam, when the gold comes in, give me a call.
Yeah, very good.
I go buy it.
I do something very similar, which is at the end of every year, after I've paid all my bills, I take whatever the money left in my checking account is, and I just put it into. I've bought bullion and also St. Gaudens, but I know as you do that this paper money system that we have is unsustainable, and I don't know when or how exactly it's going to break or crack, but history is fairly unanimous that governments that finance their deficits with the printing press. Those never end up. That doesn't ever end up well.
Right, and we're doing things with monetary policy that would make Romans look like nuns, and
it would make Caligula look like a nun.
Well, you know, the Romans had this affinity for sheep, and I think our central bankers have caught on to that, And they're just doing stuff, and the world is cheering because right now we're benefiting at some stupid level. That is to say, asset prices are being inflated by their printing. I can't see much else benefiting from it, but somehow people think of their Apple shares and Netflix shares, and what's that, CYNK? That was a hot news story for a while. A productless company with one employee, no revenues, ran up to $6 billion market cap. You know, there's a value investing crowd for you. So, you know, stupid things like that start happening, and then you got someone like Yellen, who I think is actually, so you had Greenspan, who was a sociopath. You had Bernanke, who was an academic, which is almost synonymous. But he doesn't bother me as much. And you got Yellen, and I think she's a lightweight. Just a hunch. I don't think she's up to the task.
I wonder which will be best. I think of the
might
three,
be Yellen.
I'd prefer a lightweight, yeah, because at least she's
going
to be afraid
of
going off on these ridiculous adventures, whereas...
What I think she's going to do, though, is she's going to do exactly what she thinks Bernanke did, but she's... And he did too much of it, right? So I bet you would agree that maybe if during the crisis he had, like, you know, slopped money into the system... And then as soon as the real crisis phase was over, he pulled back and said, okay, you guys are now on your own.
Yeah, but you know...
That's not crazy, but he didn't stop.
So the Bag-Hot, the famous British banker of the mid-1800s, the Bag-Hot guide to central banking was always, in a crisis, lend unlimited amounts of...
The solvent institutions.
Of lend unlimited amounts of paper money to high quality collateral at a punishing rate of interest. That was always the solution. And what that brought about immediately was the demise of insolvent firms, their liquidation, and a return to normal conditions. And of course, what we're attempting to do is to have capitalism without any losers. And you see the results of this everywhere you look. The Fed now has a $4 trillion balance sheet, which means they bought every bad home mortgage out there. And, every large corporation in the world has unlimited access to free capital. And the consequences of this are going to be absolutely catastrophic, but they'll be delayed. So instead of having...
Well, this is what people don't understand. So you've got, Corporation X, or you've got, Enterprise Y. You've got some big box pharmacy sitting on the corner across from another big box pharmacy, and the reason they're there is because they can build the building and they can staff it and they can stock it and they can carry inventory for no cost. The minute it costs something, they're going in the red and they're going insolvent. So you've got these organizations that can only exist under these extreme conditions, which means the minute the extreme conditions are gone, they go insolvent. And then you're going to start getting this falling domino effect. You're going to start getting companies going belly up and, and Enterprise is boarding up, and it's going to happen immediately because they're going to be insolvent. They're not going to have the liquidity.
You just described Simon Property Group.
Yeah, I don't know those guys.
Have you been to a mall lately?
Oh, yeah, I count empty stores. I include in those, by the way, Tractor
yes.
stores, right?
And yeah, so Simon
store.
Property
probably
Group.
Probably owns them.
Simon Property Group is the largest mall owner in the United States. It's a
REIT. They're humped.
And it's currently, I think, yielding less than 5%. And they're doing these enormous refinancings where they're paying like 3.5% on 7-year money. It makes no sense. It's completely retarded. And yet when you go to the malls, there is no one there except for homeless people and folks who can't afford air conditioning.
Right. And then there are these crazy stores. So you'll find that the mall has an SPCA outlet, and they got puppies in there. There's no way they're paying a rent.
Nope.
Right, they don't have cash flow to pay a rent in the Tractor store, and then you've got the Beanie Baby store, and you've got all these crazy stores, and you know that they're there because the mall can't afford to have a boarded up store, so they're getting the real estate for free, and the mall exists because they can keep borrowing. Yes,
other thing that has gone on because of the cost of capital is absurdly low. And this is no surprise to you, Dave, but we'll just talk about it, is it's allowed folks who should have no access to credit to have unlimited access to credit. So you see things that make no sense, like America's used car store.
Oh, my God, what an obsession I have over that. I just went to buy a used car. My son just went to buy a used car. We both independently said, this is nuts. So you go to buy a used car. It'll be 3 years old, 50,000 miles, and it'll be like $4,000 below list. And the reason is because now the used car credit system has gotten so big and bloated with money that people can borrow any amount of money to buy the used car. So they'll buy a 3-year-old car for just a little less than the new car. It's priced wrong.
So and they're paying. Yeah, and they're paying 17 to 23% interest on these loans. Where
right.
meanwhile the lender, largely Santander Consumer Finance, is paying less than 2% to borrow the money. I mean, this is while it lasts, this is the best business in the world.
Well, but don't pick on Santander, because when we have another crisis, we're gonna have something to sell all our crap to, like we did the last time. And we said it to those guys, right? When the Europeans
right the idiot bankers from Dusseldorf
buying our mortgage-backed securities, I knew what was coming next. I'm like, oh my God, we just duped them. Unbelievable.
Well, in this case, just to clarify, Santander Consumer Finance was taken out by private equity in 2009, 2010 timeframe, and was just recently spun back off to the public in January.
Well, that's always good.
Yeah, they got out before the crash. What else is being inflated by this absurd policy? Interestingly, new homes are not. People have there's been scorched by that. They haven't gone into the home business, even though the interest rates are ridiculously low. Instead, they're buying used cars, and instead they're going back to school. Now, Dave, this is an area you have probably some expertise in, but maybe you can't speak as frankly as you might. But what
no,
do you
I can
think?
I can speak totally frankly. Whatever I don't tell you, it's because I don't know it.
What do you think the real market value of an English degree from Cornell is?
Oh, dearie me. Now you took me right to the edge of that promise. Well, one of the things you'll find about a Cornell English major is that they're smart bastards, right?
And yes, they are.
You know, one of the studies about the value of a college education is they often fail to factor in that you called out smart bastard.
Right. So when you equalize for SAT scores, the value goes right out the window.
I think there's truth in that. And so you know, if we accept a kid into our grad program from some place like Princeton or something, what we're actually doing is we're saying Princeton's already called out the idiots, right?
Yeah.
And so in some sense we're taking the top of the top. And then we just sort of refine our views. English major from Cornell could go anywhere from if they borrow $200K to be an English major, they're in trouble. Right? I don't. It's unless they know what they're going to do with it, they're in trouble. It's not a self-extinguishing debt. Now, if it is self-extinguishing, I'm going to get killed for this one. If it is self-extinguishing, it's because they're clever and they knew what to do with it.
Yeah, they got an internship at Facebook
and major BA.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
So what happens? They'll go to law school.
Right. Well, that's good. That's right. That's what we need.
Yeah. And then they'll rack up another couple $100,000, and then they will be toast.
Now, Aaron, why don't you share the story of your lady friend, speaking of law school stories.
Keep it clean.
Yeah.
This is classic.
It's a Black Label show.
This is classic.
Anyway, Meg's girlfriend, lovely girl. She, single mother.
Maybe you could speed it up a little bit.
All right, just take it easy. Single mother. Anyways, I told her, I said, look, law school is not a good idea. She could have done anything she wanted to. She has great people skills. She's very smart. Yeah, very smart, voluptuously smart.
Yes.
And she's gorgeous. And
She's got big brains.
Big brains,
Dave.
Two of them. And yeah. She could have gone into medical equipment sales, any type of sales, and absolutely murdered it.
Those right. hammers right. work to sell.
Instead, she decides to borrow everything she can in the world. To the tune of $190,000.
$190,000?
To graduate from, she went to like a terrible school at first, private school that was ridiculously expensive, transferred to a top-tier law school, University of Florida, gets her JD, passes the bar, but now has some kind of blemish thing that she's going through because she filed a bankruptcy, and there's this thing called ethics, I guess, or something like that. I don't know what lawyers would know about ethics, by the way. And now there's a very good chance that she will never be accepted into the Florida bar, and yet she's sitting on $190,000 that cannot be discharged.
Right.
How does that end?
I don't know, but I'll tell you why. It's one of the big problems we face, because if you neuter, I mean, this is kind of at the level of like the mutilation of Iraqi women's genitalia at this point, right? This is really not a good idea. And if we neuter a generation with heaps of debt, these are the guys who supposedly are going to create the future and bail us out by creating new businesses and things like that.
There's not enough of them for that. But there is enough of them to create a whole new population of people who are completely and wholly dependent upon the government. I mean, who are you going to go vote for when your actual solvency, your ability to feed your family, depends on the government's policies towards your student loans?
There's no chance.
You're going to vote for whoever promises you the lowest rate on your student loan.
And the sense of futility, though, is enormous, too.
Oh, it's
demoralized.
They've created tens of millions of people who are essentially enslaved, who will never, ever pay off those student loans in real terms. There's just no way. It's completely insane.
Well, think of the other end of the scale, too. Think how many people in either 02 or 09 who got their ass kicked. And then said, well, I gotta rebuild my life, and I'm 50 years old, and I just got laid off from my job, and so what am I going to do? I'm going to go back to school. So they take the last of their savings, and they go back to school, right? They're humped too, right? Now they're the crowd that has no retirement money. They probably have debt. Of course they have a mortgage and a loan on their car, right? And they're too old to catch up. They're going to be eating ramen soup in retirement, in old age, should I say.
All right, listen.
This is a rant-a-thon.
We're going to move on to a second topic. I don't know how you feel about this topic. I don't know if you know anything about it at all, but I wanted to get you.
By the way, for the record, we did not script any of this in case people
I think that's probably pretty clear.
I think people understand that. Don't worry. Yeah. All of our listeners are used to non-scripting.
Okay, just in case. So, I'm hoping to get a tape of this out of you guys, by the way.
$10 a month, we'll send you a subscription. I'm kidding, Dave. We'll send it to you for free.
Dave, one of the things I did this summer was I sat down and 9 days in a row I wrote what we call the Digest, which is a daily email that's only available to paid subscribers. So it has a little more meat on the bone than the usual free e-zines that we publish. And I sat down and I tried to do was I tried to write about Basically, like the nine things that I think that every individual investor should know and understand to be successful. And the first essay was just very basic. It was the seven ETFs you can buy for almost nothing that will give you a very diversified portfolio that's highly likely to outperform the MSCI World Index almost every year. And it's all sensible stuff. So these new ETFs that are well designed, the shareholder yield ETF from Cambria, for example, things right. like this. So just sensible finance, so that if your ideal as a passive outside investor is to put your money someplace and go to sleep, this is how you should do it. And the second essay I wrote was the only sector of the stock market that I'm going to personally teach my children about. And that sector is insurance. And I don't know how much time you have spent, if any, studying the insurance sector. But I wanted to, every time we do a Black Label show, we try to give our subscribers like the really big inside super secrets of the stuff that we do. And I wanted to run this by you because I think it's something you'd be fascinated by too. And insurance companies are—they're great. First of all, they're great because Buffett has written about them quite a bit, so it's easy to get a very in-depth knowledge of insurance companies for free. Because the guy who knows more about insurance than anyone in the history of the world has written about it for the last 40 years, and all that writing is available for free on Berkshire Hathaway's website. All you got to do is just look through it, or you can just subscribe to my newsletter because I've already done it for you and here it all is. But the thing that Buffett says that's so unique about insurance is it is utterly a commodity business because all of these companies compete on the same basis, right? They're all competing in underwriting, they're all competing in investment performance, and they're all competing in the growth of their book of business. And to the buyer of insurance, it's all the same. You don't really care whether you're with Geico or whether you're with Allstate. It just doesn't make any difference. It's Allstate regulated. It's all the same. So Buffett points out that the key for investors then is you've got to figure out which companies are the best underwriters.
Right.
And that ends up determining almost exclusively the performance of the stocks because everything else is more or less the same.
So the best underwriters are the ones who do best due diligence on their customers that they're writing for? Is that what dictates best underwriters?
So there's three ways that insurance companies can increase their ROE. And the one is they can make a profit on their underwriting. And so if their combined ratio is less than 100, that means that they're making money on their underwriting. And there's a stock out there you can check out, listeners or Dave. It's called RLI. And it used to be a long time ago in the business of insuring contact lenses. And then, as people stop using contact, they got into other types of insurance. And this, by the way, this is all property and casualty. Life insurance companies is a whole different animal, which those are not typically great performing investments. But property and casualty can be. And Dave, you'll love the reason why property and casualty is the only sector I'm going to teach my children about. And it's so simple that once you understand it, I promise it'll change the way you invest. And that is, you think about it, this is the only sector of the entire economy that has a positive cost of capital. They get paid capital. And then if there's an accident, they pay it back. Right? So it's
I thought that was true for all of them. How is that different than the other forms of insurance?
Well, no.
I know Buffett talks about this all the time.
It's only different from life insurance in that everyone dies.
Right?
No difference in underwriting for anybody because everyone's using the same actuarial table and everyone dies, right?
Well, with the Ebola, though, that could come in pretty fast.
That's a good point.
But if you're insuring oil rigs, then your underwriting makes a great deal of difference because most oil rigs are destroyed. So I'm just saying that's why we avoid life insurance, and the answer is because everybody dies. But with property and casualty, you can make a large profit on underwriting. RLI, for example, is the best underwriting company that I know of. They make about 12% annually in underwriting. So just think about that for a second. They're making a 12% return on the capital that they've been given before they ever even invest it.
And the other thing that's interesting is this Stockman. You guys still there? I'm getting all sorts of whammy.
Yeah, we got you.
We got you, Stockman.
Okay. Stockman actually talks about AIG, for example, in his book, and he points out what I think was obvious, but no one pointed out, was that when AIG hit the wall with their derivatives, they were never at risk of going insolvent because of all the statutes that cordoned off their insurance company away from their derivatives trading. So this notion that we have to save AIG was a complete lie. Oh, those guys would never lie.
It was a total lie. Yeah,
it was a total lie. And so what happens is that it was just, you know the drill. So they can bail out the banks. The same banks were going to bail out because of goddamn Argentina. That's a funny story too, right?
So listen, I just want to. I it is a funny story, and I we'll get through this, and we can get on to a more funny topic. But I wanted to give my readers this heads up, because we're writing an issue that's coming out tomorrow that is a review of some of our best work on insurance. And my analysts were pressing me about this issue of why we want to focus so much on underwriters. And I discovered it by looking backwards. I went and found what the best performing insurance stocks were, and then I figured out what made them different than everybody else. And the difference was underwriting. And my analyst said to me, Porter, does it really matter? Because there's three ways that insurance companies can increase their ROE. They can grow their book of business. That makes sense, right? They sell a lot more insurance. They're going to make a lot more money. The stocks are going to go up. They can have, as you said, better underwriting. Or they can be better investors. So like
But they're going to suck at that. That's the problem, right?
So W.R. Berkley, for example, owns nothing but bonds. He doesn't even make an effort to be a good investor. He focuses solely on underwriting, and his stock is up 8,500% over the last 10 years. So,
yeah, but what's going to my obsession this year is the bond market. What's going to happen to that guy when the bond market?
Well, I'll tell you, and you should go read W.R. Berkley's annual reports and his quarterly reports, because he addresses it really a very interesting way. And he, by the way, started his insurance company from his dorm room in Harvard. Pretty smart dude. Anyway,
as an English major,
I think he was an English major,
wow.
Actually. But he still owns 20% of the company. Anyways, the reason why what's so interesting to me about these, if you find companies that are good underwriters, you'll also find they have a large amount of insider ownership. You'll also find they have no insider selling ever, and you'll find that they're led by good investors and they treat their shareholders right. Because they're in this for a reason. And the reason is that over the long term, nothing compounds like solid underwriting. Nothing. And you think about it, the other two elements are always unknown. It's unknown whether or not your advertising will work. It's unknown how your competitors will price their insurance. You cannot you cannot predict or promise to grow your book of business. It can't be done.
How about indexing it then? Or is that too mindless?
And likewise, hold on 1 second, the indexing. And likewise, you can't know what your investment returns are going to be. Like you said, the bond market's fickle. The stock market's fickle. You can't know. You just can't know that. But you can know that if you collect $1 billion a year in premiums and you always price your insurance appropriately, you're going to make a hell of a lot of money every single year, no matter what happens in the economy, no matter what happens in the stock market.
So that's why
if you want, and I know a lot of people are looking for this today. If you want something that is safe and sound and very likely to survive almost anything, go with well-managed property and casualty insurance companies. And, of course, there's a list of them in our Stansberry data product, which I'm not trying to sell. You can do it on your own if you want. But here's the last interesting point, Dave. The key to evaluating these companies is understanding the value of the companies, the book value of the company, and the value of their insurance float. And you have to know both those numbers to understand what the companies are worth compared to their market cap, because insurance float is counted with our accounting systems as a liability. Even if they make a profit on their float every year, year in and year out, it's still counted as a liability. So in other words, these companies oftentimes look expensive, but they're dirt cheap.
Because they have this huge liability.
Yep. And so what we do in Stansberry Data is we calculate the float for you and the book value. We put those together and we tell you, don't buy it unless you're getting it at 50% of book and float. And if you do, you're going to make a killing. And the interesting thing is float cannot be calculated on a Bloomberg machine. So it's,
you got to do your hard work.
You've got to do a lot of hard work, and that's what makes this approach still valuable in the market, because, of course, most people can't calculate it, and the people who can are frequently too lazy to do so. So I wanted to put that out there because I think it's something that you would be interested in, and at some point, if you got into it yourself,
would
you might decide to write about
it. Putting fresh money into it now is the question.
Yes, and here's why. Again, because the issue is we are not expecting to make a profit on the bonds. We're not expecting to make a profit on the stocks. We're not expecting to make a profit on the growth of the business. We're only expecting to make underwriting profit. And we value the businesses on that way. And on that basis, if you buy them at half of book and float, you're going to do great. So we're actually recommending one tomorrow.
When you work backwards, you take these companies you like, and you go back to 07 and you track them through 09.
Yep.
How'd they do?
They do fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
That's the stress test. We've now got a built-in stress test.
Yeah, absolutely. You can take a look, and they have permanent capital. I mean, that's the great thing about these guys. So, you know, someone comes in and buys an insurance policy. It's paid for, right?
Right.
Everything else that happens doesn't matter. they've already got the capital. So that's what makes these things rocks of Gibraltar. And like you said about AIG, it was a big lie that the insurance policies were going to fail. It was never going to happen. So
Well, it's actually just a fib by their standards, but yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that I know you do a great job with educating lots of individual investors, and I think this is a topic that's just right up your alley. And I think it's perfect for outside passive investors because these management teams, they own huge amounts of these businesses. They're very dedicated. The ones who can do the high quality underwriting, and these things are just compounding machines. And their capital is free. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I'm still trying to wrap my brain around the portfolio. It's one thing if they don't depend on making it. It's another thing if they get crushed.
Okay. So the way that W.R. Berkley does it is he says all the time he can't wait for higher rates. Because
me neither. Right.
Well, he says, look, we hold all of our bonds to maturity. So we don't
right.
care what the price goes to. We only own double A or higher corporate paper. And as rates go up and we roll these bonds over, we'll be earning more on our portfolio, not less.
And
the nice thing is I agree with you, there will certainly come a time, hopefully the 10-year yield goes from 2.5 to 4.5 or something like that. And that will spook people out of financials in general. And as they sell financials, they will, of course, sell insurance companies because they're idiots.
That's my thought.
Yep. That will be the appropriate.
I have so much cash. And you know, a friend of mine, Grant Williams, he has it. And we just assure each other we're not idiots, right?
Yeah. Well, I think.
Waiting.
Anyway, if you already own gold, because I think your bigger risk owning insurance stocks is the impact of inflation. You know, these things should be compounding at 6 or 8% a year and looking great. But if inflation's really 10 or 12, you know, come 20 years later, you're going to look good on paper, but you're not going to look good at the soup kitchen.
Right.
So if you've got gold as a hedge, I think insurance companies are freaking perfect.
Well, I have gold as a hedge. I'm looking for normal. That's why this is a great discussion for me, because I got plenty of the wingnut stuff. And I have the cash, which everyone says is worthless crap. I have plenty of gold, which says that I'm wearing tinfoil hats with antennas sticking out of it. But I've got also, and I'm a big energy fan, but those companies are very credit sensitive, so they scare me a little bit in a crunch. And I think we're going to have a credit crunch. So.
Yeah,
the energy companies are going to beat me up pretty good at some point.
Yeah, those guys in Texas, they love debt.
Well, I'm worried about the frackers putting up wells at a breathtaking pace and all on borrowed money, and they could really go.
Well,
they could go insolvent.
Some of them surely will. But did you see EOG's annual report for 2013?
No, I didn't. I used to own EOG as a standalone, but I don't.
You've got to take a gander because it tells you what a well managed company can do. They drilled, 416 wells in the Eagle Ford last year.
Right.
And on the entire drilling campaign, including the wells that they drilled in the second half of the year, on the entire capital that they spent on that campaign, they made more than 100% of it back in 2013.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
That's a self-extinguishing bet.
Yeah, and how many dry holes do they hit?
I'm guessing not many.
Zero.
Well, they're probably working a big field where it's about as hard as prospecting for water in a swamp.
So I agree with you your philosophy. There will certainly be oil companies that are over leveraged that perform poorly. But at the same time, the economics of the shale really change things because there aren't any dry holes, and that really makes a huge difference in the returns that are possible in a very low risk way.
Yeah, there's some risk out there. Like, for example, the state of California, I think, might shut fracking down. Not that that's a big component, but and I actually understand why fracking there's a little riskier than other places, because it's one thing to contaminate a well; it's another thing to contaminate some gigantic aquifer, right? So I think there's places maybe fracking shouldn't occur because of that, because of the capabilities of wiping out, you know, in a Fukushima sort of way. Big freshwater body, but
you know, the good thing too is the industry is always inventing new types of fracking. Have you seen the latest where they're using very small nuclear devices for fracking?
But the Greens love that one. They're just trying to find a way to dispose of the rods.
My buddy Cactus says, "Hell, give me a thermonuclear bomb, and I'll frack the whole state of Texas."
Yeah, I asked Jack if that was the name his mother gave him.
No, I'm teasing. They're not, of course, using nuclear devices for fracking, but I do love...
I bought it.
I do love I love sizzling all the tree huggers at that idea.
Yeah. You know, my wife's a Green, and I say, let's just consume less, right? Just buy less shit. That's Green. So... doesn't seem to sit quite well when garden tools involved.
My favorite Green thing is the whole water issue. I mean, people who think we're running out of water are just insane. I mean, it just.
But there are regions of the country where they got.
Oh, heaven forbid! We'll have to build a pipeline.
I know, but that could take a while.
And oh God, it'll take 18 months.
Thirsty
we can't. You know,
I don't know.
Well, do you believe you put people on the moon or not?
Yes, I believe we put. Don't make me too weird here.
All right,
we put people on.
Well, I mean, if we can figure out how to put a man on the moon, chances are we can figure out how to build a straw from Lake Michigan to wherever we need it.
You know, I think that's true, but I'm also don't have the confidence that we can somehow get of our own way to do it as efficiently.
Oh, sure, but I mean, there's so many other way more complicated problems we're going to fuck up even worse.
I know, but so we managed anyway, to fuck
the water
a lot
one
of
is
stuff
the water
up,
one's
right?
My favorite. The water one is absolutely my favorite. I also I also love the whole global warming craze.
That I'm totally agnostic on.
Yeah, I mean,
I totally don't have an opinion. If you look,
there's an article in Science in June that showed someone did an atmospheric study over Boston looking for methane leaks and the city's natural gas pipeline system. And you'll never guess that the entire fucking system leaks massive amounts of methane everywhere. So my whole favorite thing is, you know, these people are pointing at the cars and the planes and the buses. And meanwhile, you know, anywhere there's a pipeline system, there's huge fucking amounts of methane going into the atmosphere. And that's way worse as a greenhouse gas than anything that comes out of your car.
I love the
absolute idiot myopicness of these folks, and of course their enemies are all politically picked, not scientifically picked.
I don't have a horse in this race because I only have so much bandwidth, and I'm not going to think or worry about global warming for two reasons. One is because it's just too much bandwidth needed. Second is because I don't think we're going to do anything about it anyways, and so we're going to do the experiment. We're going to find out if they're right or if you're right, and it's just going to be we're going to sit back and watch. But I talk to a lot of scientists, and I know they could be retards, right? I get that, but they all, different fields of biology and agronomy and all sorts, they all buy the global warming story.
Yes, because it's the greatest source of scientific funding in the world.
Well, these are
newsletter business always being bearish, you know? Like, it's not good. It's not good for business.
I've been accused of that, yeah.
I'm just telling you. That's I just ask people. That one I like to ask, and I just like throw it on. I throw a log on the fire.
I know you're right, and I know probably 75% of the scientists involved in it would all agree with you that, and they all the way I know
they're
wrong.
These are
not
global
now,
warming experts. These are people who study. Oh,
I got it. I know they're physicists.
Like
they're just smart
yeah,
people.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I talk to a lot of these folks too. But the way I know they're wrong about global warming, there's a couple of different ways I know. It has nothing to do with bandwidth. It just has to do with human nature, almost anthropology, if you will. The moment in an argument, one side accuses the other of being insane if they don't believe in the theory. That's when you know,
yeah.
Right? Because you
it's
only,
sort of a Godwin's law model, right?
Right. Yeah. You only go to that point when you actually have no other data. It's like when a really drunk guy is at the bar and his wife says it's time to go home. We have a babysitter, and the guy says, "I don't even know if that's my kid." Right, like that's the last.
It means you know what it means. It means you have a brain worm.
it's the last act of a desperate man. It's the same thing with the pointing the finger and saying that these other folks, you know, a lot of whom are extremely well credentialed, very well intentioned, genuine scientists who are interested in answering a question. Right, you point your finger
right.
at that guy who's spent his entire life in pursuit of science, and you say you're just a crackpot, you're just a fool, you're just a religious zealot.
Right. Right?
No, he's not.
Right. Well, I'm remaining agnostic and I'm remaining apathetic because I'm confident that whether it's right or not, there's nothing I can do about it.
I think that's smart. One last question before we let you go. I'm sure you've got better things to do at Cornell University than talking to two idiots.
I'm standing here in Newport, Rhode Island.
Oh, you've got lots of better things to do then. That's a very nice place.
Well, I just read.
All right, we'll let you get back to reading. One last question, though. You talked about the $6 billion company with one employee and no products and no revenues. What, in your mind, out of all the madness that's out there right now, what is your gigantic, most obvious, super stupid sign at the top? Something that in decades from now people will look back and go, why didn't anybody notice this?
Well, I mean, there's several. One of them is the unfunded liabilities, but you've talked about that extensively. I coined the phrase bond caldera.
Ooh, I
and
like
I actually
that.
Googled it. I Googled it, and best I can tell, it's mine. I put a TM right above that puppy. And
nice.
And it's
bond
caldera. Bond caldera, yeah. And I'm trying to get virality out of you guys.
There's plenty of that virality across the table from you.
No, I'm clean.
Who knows what's cooking in that cesspool?
That's not true.
I am not talking STDs here, guys.
I'm clean, ladies. We don't have any of that.
The bond bubble is so large, so global, so encompassing that you can't see it unless you're in space looking down, right? I mean, it's like the Yosemite caldera. And I can document. You just look at the interest rates, which you're clients know full well, they correlate inversely with price, right? So lower rate, higher price, meaning stupid buyers. You've got, Spanish 10 years at 3.5%, and Italian 10 years at 3.5%, Mexican 50 years. The fact that they exist is insane, but they're paying 5.5%. And the Mexican corporate junk bond market, right? There's an index for that. I can't imagine. I know there are corporations in Mexico, right? And it's returning, it dropped to 5.23%. Rwanda, 10 years, less than 6.
Wow, that's for right? me. That's the
that's
Rwanda,
that's got to be
it. That's it. Yeah, Rwanda.
These guys, their primary business is machete services.
Right, right? Chopping arms
nuts.
Off.
Machete
yeah,
services.
Yeah, these guys are selling wings for a living over there. Right?
Yes,
and,
that's
and
what they're
so,
good at.
Right. So I look at this. And it's not about the U.S. 10-year, which is nuts, or the British 10-year, which hasn't been this low since 1721 or some crazy thing like that. And you know, Argentina, right? Did you see it defaulted last night?
That was a selective default.
No, I don't think so.
That's what Moody's called it. They called it a selective default.
Yeah, they're
default.
Bullshitting, too.
And I thought it's kind of like being selectively pregnant.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Well, they're in the first trimester.
D- Dave, you got me. You got me with. You got
yeah, you
me with,
killed him.
You got me with machetes.
You got the. You got. You got the old Porter. Porker Scamsbury horse laugh out.
Oh, yeah. I got it. We gotta go. We have to call it. We it's not going to get any better than Machete Services.
Right.
That's an all-time. Okay. That's an all-time line on the Black Label Show. Never has anything funnier been said.
You guys gotta get new guests on. I can do better.
I gotta write a whole digest about that. About there's a corporation from Rwanda called Machete Services, and its bonds are now yielding 6%.
That's the ultimate.
Oh, Dave, it's such a great pleasure. When am I gonna get to see you again?
There was some discussion of your meeting in Nashville.
Nashville, yeah, that's the last meeting of the year. We'd love to have you back. We'll have to get our people together. And
you guys have to make the first move on that one.
Yeah,
I think.
We'll have to make that happen.
You sort of did, and we'll find a way. We'll find a way. We can chat again.
Listen,
and,
do me a favor. I am going to be speaking on a panel with Alan Greenspan.
You're lying. No, again. This is for real.
That's crazier than the nuke fracking that I've come
from.
They're actually gonna put me on in front of a live microphone right next to Alan Greenspan.
Well, you know,
it's the third
weekend
in October in New Orleans, and if I text you the details, I'd love it for you to give me a little Twitter shout out about it, I'd also love it if I'll get you a transcript of what goes down, because no matter what the audience asks, I'm going to be asking Greenspan a question about his crazy monetary policy. But if you have time and you're interested, you know, any suggestions you've got to needle Greenspan, I will, of course, take very seriously.
By the way, Jameson asked me for suggestions for, I think it's Nashville, and I didn't think much about it. And I noticed that you got a couple of them. Now maybe it had nothing to do with me, but someone like Tim Price is a really underappreciated guy, and I see you got him coming in, and
great,
and he's good. He's really good.
Very good. Well, it's such a pleasure. You're a like mind, and I will never forget Machete Services.
Never, Dave. One real fast. Actually, a couple things. What's your obsession with dog pictures and weird little kid pictures on your Twitter?
Well, let me just clarify, it's not weird little kids with dogs, just for the record. I love, after I'm reading all the garbage you and I and we all read, every once in a while I'll go and post a cute puppy picture. It's kind of like a detox for me. And there's this Twitter feed called Cute Emergency, and they have just these really amazingly cute puppy pictures. I'll just go post those suckers, you know, just to break the tension. After you post 20 posts in a row on Argentine defaults, you got to break the rhythm there somehow. So what was it, the kids thing? What was the other thing?
Yeah, you for a couple of days you posted this.
There was some
I hope this is Photoshop, but and it was like a kid with like 50 teeth, and it was so scary looking.
He was like part chimpanzee, part human.
Where did you find that? It's so disturbing. Don't ever post that again. It disturbed me.
They were disturbing. It was from a listicle, and it was about bad hair. But if you looked at the kids, you go, Jesus Christ, it's not the hair, dude. It's the kid. They're ugly. So you're right. I posted, you know, sort of sporadically a couple of pictures of kids who were the most hideous kids you ever saw. One was this blonde girl.
That's the one.
6 years old, and she looked. She looked like future Lagarde or something. She really looked nasty.
I thought it was a little boy. He looked like he looked half chimpanzee.
I ended up taking a screen capture of that and torturing a lot of friends on the list with your post. So actually, I do enjoy it.
Yeah.
Keep tweeting those things.
And listen, one more time before we go, Dave. How can folks find you again? They go to Google search and they type in.
Dave Goes Rogue.
Dave Goes Rogue.
And you'll find links to everything I do. And then, of course, I'm not working under a pseudonym, so if anyone needs to contact me for some reason, if they're not smart enough to go to the Cornell Chem website and find me and find my email, I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah, they can find you. I've done that.
If they can't figure that one out,
yeah,
they don't need to find you if they can't figure that out.
Yeah, it's probably best not to remind them of that, actually.
Right.
And then what about your Twitter? How do people link up with you using Twitter?
Oh, that's at David B. Collum, my name.
David B. Collum, okay.
Yeah, one word, of course.
All right, very good. Brabham, you got anything else for our friend?
I'm gonna
find out how many guys who actually listen to you by my follower count in about an hour.
Oh, that'd be good.
I'll say, look, I got two more followers.
Well, we'll post this. It might be up. It's going to probably be up. We'll try to get it up today. If not, it might be tomorrow. But so, Dave, just one more thing is, do you have any friends that are professors? Because most of them are liberal, not many conservatives.
You know, it's not as bad as you think.
Good.
It depends on the department. But I've got colleagues who are liberals and colleagues who are more conservative. But even the Democratic ones, in the chemistry department, you find some pretty rational people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're grinding it out. We're doing a lot of deductive reasoning. And the fact is, it's a guy who for a living does deductive reasoning and untangling complicated problems. They're pretty hard to dupe. Right?
That's
guys are smart. And so now you go over onto our art squad and you go into the humanities, you're going to find some guys who are also just as smart, but they're a little more prone to be blinded because some people, we have to raise money and we run like small startups as research groups. So we really have to be grounded a little more than, say, the average. I'm not naming the field because I'll get strung up by them if I do. They're a little more in touch with their feelings, though, Dave. Yeah, and you know, I was told on campus that there's one minority group that's profoundly conservative on average. I'm not naming it, but there's a minority group that I'm told is majority Republican.
Interesting.
A minority.
Well, keep doing your thing, man. We appreciate it.
We enjoy it. We enjoy the conversations, and we look forward to seeing you again, Dave.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Bye bye.
Stansberry Radio is a purely public broadcast and is not intended to be personalized financial advice for any individual specific situation. Each individual's financial situation is unique, and Stansberry Radio should not be relied upon and or considered as personalized advice. Stansberry Radio is not licensed to render personalized advice and should be considered simply the public opinions of Stansberry Radio and its guests. Recommendations on specific financial securities are not intended to address any listener's particular financial situation.